Well, as you know, this we went to Dumas for a conference, youth conference, and me and Noemi Boutte, I think is how you pronounce her name. She's from Canada. She spoke, and Sam Eaton spoke. And we recorded Noemi and Sam, and they attempted to record me, but fortunately, mine was destroyed. No, it wasn't destroyed. It never got recorded. So I get the privilege of being alone in a room with no crowd in front of me to reproduce the audio, so which I need. So this is, works out for everybody. All right, so this is the me going over the outline of the presentation that I made in Dumas, Texas at the youth conference called Shine, put on by Heather Boyce. And so here we go. I did show a video during this, but that video is not going to come through, of course, on this audio, so we're going to skip that. You can find it on YouTube. It's called What is Truth? Then Pilate said, "So you are the king." So you are a king. Jesus replied, "You say that I am king. For this reason I was born, and for this reason I came into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone who belongs to the truth listens to my voice." Then Pilate asked, "What is truth?" You know, the world, nothing has changed. The world still asks, "What is truth?" And Jesus still proclaims that he is truth. And that's where we are. We're in a world that is still questioning truth, trying to redefine truth. In fact, the word philosophy means the study, or at its core it does, it means the study of truth, how we define truth. That's the study of philosophy. There's a lot of other things that go into philosophy, but at its core, that's primarily what it is. Today, I would like for us to look at three different stages of Western philosophy and how we have looked at truth during those three stages. Before we get into the three stages, though, as an introduction, I would like to go over briefly the difference between Eastern and Western philosophy. Eastern philosophy, we're talking majorly about China, Asia, into the Middle East, and including Israel. This way of thinking, or this Eastern thought, is primarily concerned with good and evil, good versus evil, how they line up. And when it comes to knowledge at all, it's really more about wisdom than knowledge. And the difference there is wisdom being much more about how to use what you have, or when to use a certain, you know, aspect of life versus what you actually know. So the writings of this time all reflect that, reflect wisdom and good versus evil and a thing called karma. The karma, and all these things feed into our lives even today, because America is very much a hodgepodge of Eastern and Western thinking. The Eastern thinking that we have is, for example, of karma, is you can say what comes around goes around, if you've ever heard that statement, or you get what you deserve. These are very much karma thinking. This is very much Eastern way of thinking. The Bible, the Old Testament especially, was written under the Eastern way of thinking. Read Psalm 73. It's all concerned with good and evil. And most of Proverbs is concerned with wisdom. And where there is knowledge, it's usually talked about as knowledge of God, which they consider to be more wisdom than a Western philosophy would view it as knowledge itself. Now, Western philosophy came out of Greek and Roman, that area. And it is mainly concerned with knowledge, as we've said, but hard facts and things that can be proven and things like that. Also, existentialism and they were concerned with existence and what existence meant and being and those kinds of things. And what was the real truth behind being? What was the what tied everything together? What was the quintessential? I mean, these were the pursuits that they had in Western thought. So then we move. Now, quickly, I just wanted you to see that because I wanted you to know that it was more complicated, way more complicated than what I'm going to be presenting today. And this is just a brief overview and a basic study of the three different stages of Western thinking. Now, prior to 1600, Western thinking was called, or was defined as, pre-modernism. Now, there's the three stages of pre-modernism, modernism, and post-modernism. And you can tell by the names that these classifications were come up with during modernism itself. So pre-modernism really is defined by modernism. And modernism is really the turning point to everything. Without modernism, it wouldn't have led into post-modernism, because it's post-modernism is really just an answer to modernism. But let's start off with pre-modernism. We're talking about prior to 1600. And during this time, truth is revealed. Truth is God-centered. Now, I used an illustration while I was at the conference of a cup towel over an object, and I put it in front of everyone, and I said, "What do you all think is under this cup towel?" And it had been sitting there for 5 minutes since I started talking. And so I said, "You already know. You've already made some educated guesses that that it is not an animal. That you know that it's not a car. You know that it's bigger than a pencil." So they all kind of made guesses, and then I took the cup towel off and revealed a globe of the world. And that is very much an exercise in how things were taught during pre-modernism. You know, at the university, colleges, the academy is what they called it. I'm sorry. But even in any type of discipleship relationship, truth was revealed by the teacher, and truth was God-centered, because God is the revealer of all truth. Ultimately, truth was absolute. Truth was transcendent. It was true no matter what. Truth was objective. It was true for everybody at every time. Truth was actual. It was actually something factual. I mean, it was something real. It wasn't just an ideal. Truth defined logic, and this is important, because you will have people saying during this period of time, "I will come over to your house tomorrow, God willing," or "God willing, if the sun rises tomorrow, we'll be able to cut the field." There was always this this God willing thrown into everyday logic, because logic had to be constrained by was confined by the fact that God could intervene at any point, and have a miracle, that everything was sustained by God, and that he was ultimately in control. And so logic had to then account for that. During this time, the TR was a symbol, and the TR is short for Textus Receptus. And it's a accumulation of Greek documents. It was put together. These are all Greek documents about the New Testament. And a bunch of scholars got together and put together all these different manuscripts, these Greek manuscripts, which were copies of different books of the New Testament. They then threw out all of the texts that didn't match. And what was left, and there were thousands, of texts, and they threw out everything that didn't match, and they still had, I don't know how many, but it was a lot, it was hundreds at least. And this was the Textus Receptus. This was the majority, or what was later called the majority text, and it was used later on to create the King James Version of the Bible. So that's important to know, because this was put together during this kind of thinking, during this truth is revealed kind of thinking. And that truth was absolute, and that's really what they were going for. It's kind of helpful to know when you start to look at these things. Now, I'm going to carry this thread throughout this Bible thread throughout the different stages of philosophy, and so you can see how it kind of changes views, depending on the culture that it's in, the philosophy of the culture that it's in. Well, let's move on to modernism. Modernism, so we're talking about 1600 to about 1950, and this was the predominant way of thinking, or the predominant philosophy. During this time, we're talking about the rise of the scientific method and the rise of sciences in general, astronomy, biology, archaeology, and the scientific method. During this time, scientific method is where you run an experiment, and you have an idea, you run an experiment to prove your idea is true. The experiment, you predict an outcome. If the outcome is what was predicted, then you take this experiment and you send it to a friend. It has to be recreatable. So anybody can run this experiment and come up with the same answer. That then is how you determine truth. That's the scientific method. If it's true, if it's able to be repeated in the same for all people in all, all times and all places and all that, all the variables are accounted for. That's the scientific method. And so people begin to view truth as being discoverable. And the major shift in thinking here is that it became man-centered, because man is the one who discovered it. Under pre-modernism, man could seek truth, but it had to be revealed. In modernism, man discovered truth, you see, and so it's all in man's hands, and it becomes man-centered. Truth is still absolute during this period of time. Truth is external only. It has to be true for everybody all the time. And it kind of moved away from being viewed as internal and external and just being viewed as external only. Truth is I don't even know that. Truth is absolute still. We just talked about that. Truth is developing. Now, here's the other part about this. You might discover one thing about water, but not everything about water. One experiment and one scientific discovery might classify one aspect of water, or one thing that we didn't know about water before. But the truth about water was an developing thing. And this was, this was the case with all truth. Every discovery kind of developed that truth further. Now, the turning point. Now, let's go to the majority text. Now, during this period of time, during all these archaeological digs and how archaeology was kind of defined and the way to do it and everything, so you had all this expansive discoveries in archaeology, and And some of the findings in archaeology were actually manuscripts of the New Testament. So these two scholars, Westcott and Hoare, decided that they would then pursue these documents to see how they matched up, they were going to put them together and see how they matched up to the King James, or to the Textus Receptus. So they put these documents together, and what they found was they found two documents that were way older than anything that was in the Textus Receptus. And they were also shorter. Now, they had two presuppositions. They had two things that they believed to be true. One was that the older the text, the more accurate it was. And two, the shorter the text, the more accurate it was. Because they thought that, and they had reasons for thinking, they had good reasons for thinking this, but that people would add to the Bible before they would take away. That scholars, that people copying the text would add things in, but they would never take things out. And are more likely to add things than take things out. For instance, if the word was translated as he, but the scholar might be tempted to put it, and it was referring to Jesus, it was obviously referring to Jesus, the scholar might be tempted to put in the word Jesus, therefore he. And so these kinds of things led them to believe that these two documents from Alexandria were more accurate than any of the documents in the Textus Receptus, because they were older, because they were shorter. So they put together what is called the MT, or what I've called the MT, the minority text is what it was called. Or the Westcott and Hoare text, it was also called that. They put together this text, this New Testament, this new Greek manuscript of the New Testament. And they used some other documents as well, but the main two they used were these two from Alexandria. And it's called the minority text because there's only two, and the majority text, there were hundreds. But, and I wanted you to see, this. So in a lot of the other versions of the Bible, I think almost all the other versions of the Bible, this is what is used, or at least this combined with the Textus Receptus. So, just realize that, or just sort of understand what's going on and where this came from and what kind of thinking came from, because they believed, they did it themselves. They discovered truth. They discovered the truth about the Bible and a better Bible, what they thought to be a better translation of the Bible. But understand there were presuppositions there. Okay, moving on. So truth became measurable. Okay, you had to be able to measure truth. And truth became, and this is the turning point here, is that truth became constrained by logic. And what that means is no longer was logic constrained by truth, as we saw in pre-modernism. But now we have this idea that truth can only exist if it makes sense, if it makes logical sense, if it can be proven. Okay, and so because miracles can't be proven, because miracles can't be repeated in experiments, then we know you can go out and strike a rock with a staff and water is not going to come out of it. So therefore, miracles became viewed as not true, or not part of truth. They became part of religion. They weren't considered, scientifically true. And science was governing truth. And so out of this, you have Darwinism coming, because Darwin, because everything had to be explained, and so the creation of the world had to be explained. There had to be a there's a bunch of isms that come in here: rationalism and empiricism. And anyway, so one of the idealism, one of the isms that came out of this was Darwinism, and that is the idea of how the Earth came into being, how all the creatures came. In fact, Darwinism really only addresses the origin of the species, how different species came into existence, not really the origin of the Earth. But it has been applied that way later. So these kinds of ideas were predominant during this period of time, and God became not really part of truth. And so other isms came out of this too, like theism, the idea that maybe God created the Earth, but then hands off. He didn't have anything to do with it after that. He created it and let it alone, set up the rules, set up the gravity, set up these kinds of laws that we couldn't really find a reason for happening naturally. But then he's hands off because, well, you know, science trumps God, I guess, or at least we can't understand it. We can only understand science, so we're going to leave it out. The other thing that came out is atheism. There was no God at all, and things happened by accident and naturally. Ooh. So, also another important thing that happened during modernism is the establishment of the United States. This was established during modernism, and so just so you know. All right, so let's move on to postmodernism. This is where you are. This is where you live every day. This is where your culture connects with you. This is what is in your movies, in your television shows, in your music, even within the church, and how the church looks at the world around itself. Postmodernism. So what is different from postmodernism? Modernism? Truth becomes perceived. This is the most important thing. Modernism doesn't answer all the questions. And doesn't answer ethics. It doesn't. There's no basis for ethics in modernism. So when you get to postmodernism, then you find truth being perceived, and truth being situational, and truth being inclusive. Okay. So let's take a look at a couple of those. Truth is perceived. What you perceived. So let's take what I did at the conference was take an example of people's favorite colors, and I asked, you know, what is your favorite color? Who has a favorite color different than that? Okay, who has a favorite color different than these two? And I said, okay, who is right? Who is right? Which one is the best color? Well, there is no right. What's true for one person is not true for another. And this is an example of truth being perceived. So one person can believe that God is the creator of the universe and that when he dies, he'll go to heaven. And another person believes that Allah created the universe and when he dies, he will go to Allah realm. And these are two different places, even though in English they're translated both as heaven. They're definitely two different places when you study what the Bible teaches about heaven versus what the Quran teaches about heaven. So in these two different places, so these two different people believe these two different things. But it's true for both of them, and both are true. Both are just as right as the other. That's the idea that truth is perceived. Truth is situational. This comes in the form of our coaches. You know, it's called situationalism. And what it means is that knowledge is relative to your situation. You see this in our coaches when they sign a contract at a college to coach, and then all of a sudden they didn't win any games. And so the college comes back to them and says, you know what, the situation has changed. And I know we hired you for 5 years, but it's only been two. You haven't won any games. We don't really see any progress here. And so because the situation has changed, we're going to fire you and negate your contract. The other thing that happens is maybe a sports star signs with a team. He signs for a certain amount of money. He agrees to play for 3 years. But his first year is awesome, and he just does fantastic. And so after the first year, he comes back to that team and says, I know I agreed to play for 3 years for this amount of money, but it's time to renegotiate our contract because my situation has changed. This also happens in marriage. One of the reasons I think that the divorce rate within the church is the same as it is without the church is because of the situationalism and because that the church, the people in the church, are engaged in this way of thinking, that you got married, you made a promise to God to love this, to honor and obey and serve and be with this person, commit yourself to this person for your life, and you meant all that stuff. But 3 years later, 15 years later, the situation has changed. In fact, the situation has become intolerable. And it's time to change my situation. You know, no matter, so this is the idea that the truth in this situation is different than the truth was when I got married. I didn't know all the truth. If I had known now what I knew then, I wouldn't have done it. You've heard that? That's situationalism. Okay. So, truth absolutely exists. You will, originally, when this first came out, the catchphrase was that truth is not absolute. That was kind of the catchphrase, that there is no absolute truth. That truth is relative to every situation. But the problem with saying that there is no absolute truth is that that is an absolute statement. And you can corner somebody by saying, well, if truth is not absolute, if you're saying truth is not absolute, it's an illogical statement because it disproves itself. If it's true all the time, then it's false because that is a absolute truth. And if it's false, it's false. So they changed from saying that to saying absolute truth exists internally, or absolute truth is within us, and decided, you know, it's personal. Absolute truth is personal, which is just a fancy way of getting around the same problem. And the problem still exists. You just need to change the word when you're talking to somebody about this, or anybody about this, or even thinking about it yourself. Change the word from absolute to objective. Truth is objective. And if you make the opposite statement, truth is not objective, then that statement you're making disproves itself. Okay, it's the same issue. Objective means that it is not internal, that it is not situational. Objective means it's true all the time, and regardless of the situation. Okay, one of the other things that that premodernism says is that truth absolutely exists, but only within a community, and that community makes all the difference. There's many paths to God. There's a community of Islam. There's a community of Christian. There's a community of Buddha. Whatever. It's inclusive because I said that when I first started, because it includes every religion and every truth. And the problem with it is what if you're a Nazi? Is that true? I mean, you've been taught in your community that Jews are less than human, that you are the superior race of the entire planet, and that you have the right to kill whoever you want, and that Nietzsche was right, and that your community is superhuman, and you must impose your will on others, and that is the only truth there is to know. Well, of course, we fought an entire war because that truth was not objective, and because that was a lie. And even the leaders, even Hitler himself, admitted that it was a lie. And he said, you tell a lie enough times, people will believe it. And, you know, it was all about power. And he admitted so much. So that's the problem with that's one of the problems with postmodernism. I wanted to take the thread of the Bible through all the different stages. And what happens in postmodernism, because truth is perceived, it even feeds into Christianity. And so people said, well, we need to make Bibles that can be better perceived, that can be easily read. We need to go further than just putting a Bible in English, because the Bible, the King James, and I'll admit the King James, you know, anybody will admit the King James Bible is really not how we talk today. So we need to create a new Bible that people can understand better. And so during this time, you have just a plethora of Bibles since, you know, about 1950 being created. I mean, it's just overwhelming how many Bibles have come out in English. You've got the most popular ones, the NIV, the New American Standard, the Living Bible, Bible in Basic English, the Amplified, the American King James, the New King James, the New Living, the New Revised Standard, the New Century Version, a lot of churches are using that. The Message, all of these Bibles, and that's just a sampling. There's literally, I think there's like 50 that have come out during this period of time, maybe more than that. And I couldn't even get a good comprehensive list of all of them. The other thing that's happened in the church, and all of these are just, supposedly, they're just ways to perceive truth better. And because we want to reach out to our culture that surrounds us in a way that they can understand. And that's trying to that's all about truth being perceived. Okay. The other thing is the emergent churches. The emergent church has come onto the scene, and that's very much trying to reach out to the culture and trying to be non-judgmental to the culture and trying to play to this perception, trying to change the perception of truth, change the perception of the church. And so, know that. All right. Well, let's move on. I've talked enough about those different stages, and I'd like to just conclude now, and with the summation that I gave at the conference. The problem is that our message does not fit the current philosophy of our culture, but that's okay. Paul had the same problem. He spent much of his ministry bringing an Eastern religion to a Western culture. I'm sure that it was difficult for them to grasp, as we see in the letters that he wrote them. We have the exact same issue. Postmodernism, which is our culture, says that truth is perceived and not objective. It is situational and not transcendent. These ideas permeate our music, our movies, our TV shows, or even our commercials. They bleed into our everyday thinking and come out in our conversations around our dinner table, our presuppositions, and even the church's doctrines. The answer, in part, is realizing that we are not of this world. We have an alien and strange way of thinking. Truth is revealed and is absolute. Death is all around us and we are eternal. The gospel is life, abundant life, eternal life. Not a way to improve our view of life, but life itself. We are different creatures than those around us. And yes, we need to reach out to them in a language that they can understand, but we need to stop trying to convince them that we are one of them. It is not our calling to make them comfortable with the message. The Holy Spirit will comfort them or make them uncomfortable because He knows if they need to be comforted or made to move from discomfort. We should focus on surrendering ourselves and our will, even our way of thinking, to the Holy Spirit. We are not spies meant to convince the enemy that we are one of them and plot their overthrow at our King's return. We are ambassadors of life, ambassadors of peace. We study an ancient philosophy, and we should stand out. The way we talk, the way we think, the way we act. We are His witnesses, not in hypocrisy, but in truth. Jesus Christ said a prayer for us to His Father, the Creator of the universe. God in human flesh said a prayer for you and for me to the Creator of the universe. He said, I'm not asking you, Father, to take them out of the world, but that you keep them safe from the evil one. They do not belong to the world, just as I do not belong to the world. Set them apart in truth. Your word is truth. Just as you sent me into the world, I send them into the world. And I set myself apart on their behalf, so that they too may be truly set apart. John 17:15-19. And that is the end of my talk. The end. I prayed at the conference, and that was it. So I hope you enjoyed this. Please tune in the following Sundays. Next Sunday will be Noemi Boutte. I think that's how you pronounce her name. Noemi is her first name. And she will be speaking on grace and mercy. And the following Sunday, Sam Eaton will be speaking on love and tying together truth and mercy and grace. Thank you for joining us this week. Vayas con Dios.